Welcome to Worlds Apart. 20 years ago, at a press briefing about the absence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld famously uttered his quote about known knowns, unknown knowns, and unknown unknowns. And his point was essentially that free democratic countries were morally justified about assuming the worst about their adversaries and acting accordingly. Is this logic still at play in NATO's confrontation with Russia over Ukraine? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Madhav Nellapad, Director of the Department of Geopolitics and International Relations at Manipal University in India. Professor, it's good to see you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, you know, I'm a big fan of folklore and mythology, and I rarely get a chance to weave it into the conversation, even though I think you would agree with me that modern day geopolitics is all about myth-making. But with one of your recent articles, you gave me a wonderful opportunity of doing that, because you compare this whole crisis in Ukraine to the fairy tale of the Pied Piper. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, look, I'd like to point out that a lot of the policy towards President Putin and Russia seems to be driven by emotion. Now, I've been here before. In Libya, for example, there was a complete demonization of Muammar Gaddafi. There was a demonization of Saddam Hussein. And there is now a demonization of Russia as a people and the president of Russia. Now, I've studied President Putin for some time, studied his moves. I've also studied the fact that he became more and more disillusioned with the West. And it was no surprise to me, because if you track back my writing, you'll find out that I was very clear that Germany, the Franco-German alliance, will never allow Russia to be a part of Europe. Never. Because what happens when you have Russia in? These two lose out their position. So that's never going to happen. So now we find the same play of emotion. And what I'm seeing is President Zelensky wants this, he wants that, he wants this. Basically, he wants to punish Russia. I've seen the people of Iraq suffer. I've seen others suffer. So in my view, the difference is Russia is, if not the foremost, the second foremost nuclear power. It's half of Europe. It's half of Asia. You don't fool around with a state like that by thinking emotionally.
Well, Professor Nellapad, you're definitely a professor of geopolitics, so you want to be concrete, but I'm still with my humble plea of tying it to the fairy tale that you mentioned in one of your articles. And in that fairy tale, in that article rather, you compare Ukraine to that piper who was luring the children of their homes and over the cliff to their deaths, essentially. And you suggest that it is Ukraine that is doing that role. But one thing that I don't understand in this analogy, it is the Ukrainian children who are being called on to their deaths. So why do you think the Ukrainian leadership would be interested in doing that?
Well, I'd like to say that I had in mind the people following the Pied Piper of Kiev. I mean, President Zelensky. I admire his zealousness. I admire his courage. But the reality is that he is, in my view, in my calculations, and frankly, I have always assumed that President Putin is what I call a grandmaster of geopolitics. And if you're a grandmaster of geopolitics, the kind of moves that Zelensky is making, NATO move, will lead to more and more Russian counter moves. And finally, this will escalate into the nuclear cliff. That is, you're going to see tactical nuclear weapons used. In my calculation, I put this on record several weeks ago, more than a month ago. It could be in Latvia, Lithuania, or Estonia. It could be in some of the Baltic states, essentially challenging NATO to come into the field with a nuclear armed power, a nuclear superpower, which is which has declared that nothing is, no holds are barred. That is the cliff I was talking about. And I was talking about the countries of NATO following President Zelensky into the cliff. He's already pushed his people.
In your calculation, what could possibly justify that? Because, you know, if you look at Ukraine from a traditional strategic perspective, it has very advantageous geographic location. It could have had the best of both worlds. It could be milking both Russia and the West for resources. What is it to gain from calling everyone off a nuclear cliff?
The fact of the matter is, Ukraine is essential. If we are talking of a land war, Ukraine and Belarus are essential to the security of Russia or the security of the countries of the rest of Europe in case Russia wants to launch a war against them. It is from these countries, from these geographic locations, that such a geographic war on the surface, armies can come through. And this is the point. So one can understand President Putin about Belarus, about Ukraine, and also about Central Asia. Because in Central Asia, I happen to calculate that it's not just, it's not just some of the known people, but even the China that will have an interest in displacing Russia from Central Asia, in displacing India from Central Asia. And they didn't do anything to prevent this attempted color revolution, but President Putin acted. He acted in Belarus, he acted in Kazakhstan. Why? Because Central Asia is also a key element. It's a key element in our security and Russia's security. So he's after what's happening in NATO, the expansion of NATO, saying thus far and no further.
But Professor Nalbert, I think it's important to highlight that while Russia, as you said, acted in many of its neighboring countries to provide security, it's not trying to question the sovereignty of those countries. And till this day, I haven't heard officials in Russia questioning whether Ukraine should remain a sovereign state. Everything they talk about is maintaining such a posture, such a military posture that would not be threatening to Russia. Other than that, those people are free to pursue their own fate the way they see it.
Well, you're perfectly right. And I can say that I have not said that that President Putin and the Russian government is imposing any of its, its views, whether it is in Central Asia, or in the, now, so far as Ukraine is concerned, I had hopes that President Zelensky, when he came to power, would understand the logic that was there in Viktor Yanukovych. In my view, Viktor Yanukovych and Zelensky are Ukrainian patriots. Yanukovych understood that you need stable relations with Russia for a stable Ukraine. Now, unfortunately, if you regard Russia as an enemy for the next 100 years, then obviously you need a Ukraine which is completely in the NATO camp. And that is exactly where their actions are taking this. And again, if I may say so, this is the point. I really did not expect President Zelensky to really make this kind of mistake in going by Petro Poroshenko and various others, especially because he's Jewish. The Jewish community, and I've said this multiple times, I mean, they're the lost tribe of the Hindu community. They're an extremely admirable community. I never expected this from him, that he would pursue a path of these Ukrainian zealots who want to believe that Ukrainians are not Russians, that Russians are somehow different from Ukrainians. And they call Russians, for example, Asiatic.
I think to some extent it's irrelevant who they believe themselves to be. They could call themselves aliens, whatever. It's just the point is that they should not be prostituting their land to present a sizable threat to a very big neighbor. Now, I heard you say in another interview that this conflict in Ukraine began because Russia understood that America would never cease to target Russia as an enemy. Why do you think that is? Because having an enemy is an expensive undertaking. I mean, especially an enemy of the size and character of Russia. Is there any benefit to the United States as a country, or perhaps to the American elites, to have Russia as its adversary, because the Russians, and I've lived in this country for many years, I followed its policies. Russia has no state interest in seeing America as an enemy. We are interested in cooperating with them, just as you said, India is interested to cooperating with the rest of the world. But why do you think the Americans are so invested in seeing us as a bad guy or being on bad terms with us?
Well, look, the fact is that there is a very strong Europeanist streak in American security and foreign policy. The good news is that the Pentagon, for example, the Department of Defense, I'm sure they can't be very pleased about a lot of the policies of the State Department, which is much more Europeanist. And today, the White House, which is extremely Europeanist, in a way that Trump was not. Trump was a disaster in other ways, but he was not a disaster in the sense of being a Europeanist who believes that the navel of the world is still Europe. That is 50 years behind the times. And what we are seeing in some European countries regarding the, Boris Johnson is now in India, I'm sure he's going to give a lot of, Professor Johnson will give a lot of lectures on Ukraine. Poor Boris doesn't realize that it's not 100 years ago. And we are not going to listen to these lectures. We are going to do what's good for our own country. So the problem is this Europeanist group, they don't regard Russia somehow as European. Now, there are people in Russia, the St. Petersburg School, which I've talked about, which regard themselves as fully European. But I'm sorry, you are not European in my view. You are Russian, which is a Eurasian. You're the only really Eurasian country. And the Europeans regard you as being Asian. And the Americans who are pro-European or who are completely, who basically work in the European interest as defined by European elite, European leaders, they forget that their mission is now in the Indo-Pacific and it needs to change. But the good news is a lot of people in Washington, in Paris, in London, in Berlin are accepting this. So I think this kind of a very harmful policy for the Western world will end, in my view, within years.
Let's take a short break and we will return to this discussion after a few moments.
I'll look forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders are in conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence as own existence.
We need to counter the Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly, all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Worlds Apart with Madhav Nalapa, Director of the Department of Geopolitics and International Relations at Manipal University in India. Professor, before the break, we were talking about various perceptions of this conflict. And before we started, I mentioned this quote by Donald Rumsfeld about known knowns, unknown knowns, and unknown unknowns. And I wonder if you see any of those unknown unknowns already in the American policy, this ripple effect that comes back to hurt the the author of the sanctions more than the actual target.
Well, look, any kind of a policy driven by emotion, you may think that you know, and there are knowns. The point is not the accumulation of data. The point is what you understand from the data. You know, there's something called net assessment. There's something called a second opinion. I mean, in my university, our department, we are completely outside government, totally outside government. And in that sense, we provide, in a sense, a second opinion, whether people like it or not, or ask of it or not, too many things that are going on. So as far as this is concerned, now we have heard, for example, Macron say, we are talking of, I was wanting a Europe from Vladivostok to Paris. Well, the reality is, what they're really looking for is another, if I may say so, another Boris Yeltsin or another Gorbachev. And they're waiting for that. And they expected that this particular conflict would lead to a change in regime and to one more Boris Yeltsin coming up. That's what they're looking for. In our case, I can tell you, we are very clear that the security of Asia has to be looked after, yes, by North America, by Asian countries, and we believe North America is a quadricontinental country. Like Russia is a bicontinental country, North America is South American, it's Asian, it's African, it's also European. And as for St. Petersburg, my wife and I have been there. We had a lovely visit there. We're not saying, I'm not knocking St. Petersburg, and I'm not knocking modern Europeans. They are very modern, and they understand the world. I'm only talking of people who are living in the past because they still remember too much of the school textbooks, which in my view, celebrate the whole of European conquest as one great, affirmative, wonderful story for the whole of mankind.
Well, you actually lead me to a somewhat philosophical question because, when people take decisions concerning whole countries or the whole world, one would assume that they are not taking those decisions on a whim. And the United States, as well as Western Europe, have some of the highest think tank numbers per capita. I mean, there are more think tanks than universities, perhaps, in America. And yet the quality of strategic decisions that successive American administrations have taken over the last 20 years, it's very questionable. Is it ignorance? Is it a lack of strategic logic? Or is it something that we here in Moscow simply cannot understand? Because you mentioned the conflicts in Syria, in Libya before. You mentioned their policies in Southeast Asia. And it's hard to understand what the leaders in Washington are trying to actually pursue.
Well, look, this is what I'm saying. You have a whole lot of data, and then you come to different conclusions. I'm sure the data they indicated is that Russia was looking at capturing Kiev. I don't believe that. That's Western doctrine. You capture the capital. I'm not entirely sure it was the Russian doctrine. I think the Russians are land. I think about one third of Ukraine, frankly, will now effectively be separated from Ukraine, and the balance will be demilitarized and cleared of elements who are Russophobic. You know, I think the point is to Russophobic. But now, look, you're talking to a person who repeatedly visited Washington to warn about the Taliban hosting a lot of nasty people right through the Clinton period and about a month and a half before 9/11. And frankly, I don't say we will. Certainly nobody took me seriously that this is going to happen. Oh, you know, we know Afghanistan, we know the Taliban. Well, look, you know, you're fine. Iraq, we warned about Iraq that it'll be a disaster if you allow control. I was happy with Iraq, Saddam Hussein had to go, but then you appoint an American administrator and all over the place are American flags. The Iraqis are a very proud people. Libya, Gaddafi was frankly a very nasty man from India's point of view. But at the same time, we are in my case, I warn that after him, you'll have a deluge of refugees coming to Europe from Syria. And again in Syria, I've been to Syria when this problem was going on. I mean, Bashar Assad is again no friend of India, but we have continued to recognize Bashar Assad because we believe many of the people supported by the United States and by the rest of NATO were people who were terrorists one day. I've seen that. The same people who are Al-Qaeda and ISIS, after a couple of weeks, they go back and become freedom fighters, get replenished, get money, and then after a few weeks, they slip back into being Al-Qaeda and ISIS. All this has been happening. So this is not the first time that NATO is making a horrible mistake.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking about the consequences of those decisions, I think one of the things that separates this conflict from all the others is that American population at home can already feel the pinch of sanctions because prices are going up. There is an increase in fuel prices. There are some food price increases. Do you think the American populace, the American democracy, in this case, because people are affected, do you think it can affect the policy of the White House, or is it still the same old game that, you know, a few people who know nothing but pretend that they know everything will continue making decisions, not only for, you know, the American people, but for the rest of the world as well?
I've never seen sanctions being implemented on a country at such rocket speed. You know, either you've worked out these sanctions in advance, and then you're going to conspiracy theory that all this was planned. I don't believe that. Or you're just implementing sanction after sanction, thinking the next installment will finish off President Putin and will make the Russian people rush to the streets and depose him. I think that second is more likely. But the fact is, it's having an impact on the whole world, and it's having a big impact on Europe and the United States. My own calculation and guesses, within about 16 to 17 weeks at most, there is going to be an enormous blowback from this war, and people are going to identify the sanctions as being responsible. And frankly, I don't think they care where Ukraine is, whether it's with China or with Russia or with India, but they do care about their daily lives. So at most, 15 or 16 weeks before there's immense blowback, and it's already happening on a large scale, but it's just not being reported. I'm surprised that my friends in all these big papers, they seem to have suspended belief, and they seem to be accepting whatever, not the Pied Piper, but the people who are giving who are the associates of the Pied Piper. They feed NATO, NATO feeds United States and NATO feed their media. And I'm sorry to say, my friends in the media have completely suspended belief in their reporting.
Let's talk about China, because you mentioned in one of your articles that the Chinese are one of the biggest gainers from the Russian-Ukrainian conflict. Why do you think that is?
Well, the reality is that if this conflict intensifies and if there is a kinetic conflict, nuclear or non-nuclear, between NATO and Russia, for the next generation, the attention of the United States, the European segment, and the European countries will be on Russia. And they will take their eye off China. Now, the reality is we need the United States in Asia. We need the Europeans in Asia because we need to have a free, open, and inclusive Indo-Pacific. And you have a country that is publicly claiming 90% of the South China Sea, for example. And this is, completely astonishing that they're claiming this. Now, in our case, for example, for the first time since the 1980s, all across not just India, but Africa, Latin America, you are seeing a dialogue of West versus the rest, which again is not true, because Western people are not what their leaders are. But now in India, for example, I mean, you know, our prime minister is very focused on India. You have a president who's, you know, whether he does things which we like or we don't like, he's very focused on what he believes is the Russian interest. And we and the prime minister developed what is called a Vladivostok-Chennai corridor. He's also developed a corridor through Iran, Chabahar port. And that is not only for Central Asia, it's also for Russia. Because I think that Prime Minister Modi predicted this kind of a breakdown in relations between Russia and the West. And I want to ask a simple question. We're a poor country. When Europeans are spending more than we spend in a month, in an hour or 2 hours to buy Russian oil and gas, why do you want a poor country to deny itself cheaper Russian oil and gas? Why do you want us, our people who are poor, to be even poorer?
Well, perhaps because the white man said so. It's just my opinion. But can I ask you very briefly, because we are running out of time. You said that we need Europe and America in Asia to, you know, solve our various security challenges. And having seen what the American contribution to the European security has been, I mean, they literally brought Russia and Europe on the brink of a nuclear conflict. I mean, there is a hot conflict now raging in the middle of Europe. Do you really think that we need that kind of expertise to help solve Indian difficulties, let's say, with China or Pakistan? Can't we do it regionally in a manner that would try to satisfy all parties? Do you really believe that the Americans or the Europeans, for that matter, have the best interest of Asia in mind when they try to, you know, moderate various security issues?
Look, you know, you'll be surprised at the number of Indian Americans or ethnic Indians who are working in the high-tech industries in the United States. It's a very, very large number. The last I checked, it was about 1.3 million. It's probably much more now. Just ethnic Indians. And we have about nearly 6 million ethnic Indians who are in the United States. The European Union is very short-sighted. They don't mind somebody else being settling in Europe and taking full advantage of their social facilities, whose productivity will be much less than a software programmer or an engineer or a doctor from Chennai or Hyderabad or Lucknow or Mumbai. They're being short-sighted. Forget it. I'm not going to call them racist. They're being short-sighted. But, you know, I just want to say, on technology, for example, there's already a link between India and the United States. It's not a link made by government. It's a link made by lower level, but I wouldn't say lower levels, by citizens, by companies, by tech companies. Now, for example, an alumnus of my university, Satya Nadella, is the chief of Microsoft. You have another Indian, both these people, I think, are Indian passport holders. I mean, you know, you have Sundar Pichai in Google, and they're just one of thousands and thousands of Indians in the top position. So we have an organic link already, and we need that organic link. Secondly, we are united in wanting a free, open, and inclusive Indo-Pacific. We don't want an Indo-Pacific in which one country will dictate who can come in and who cannot come in, especially a country that has invaded us multiple times and cost us a loss, including of 20 soldiers last year.
Okay, well, Professor, we have to leave it there, even though there are many more questions to be asked. But thank you very much for now for sharing your insights.
Thank you. And I'd like to say I admire the Russian people and Russia. And may I say, on the few occasions my wife and I have been in Russia, we have thoroughly enjoyed our visits. God bless you and God bless the Russia, India and the world.
I totally, fully join your prayer for the world and for global peace. And to our viewers, thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.